Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
If your restaurant wants to put the best on the table, look for food with a New York State Certified seal. It's food that is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, early-ish fall is a great time to start getting things fermenting and bubbling, from cabbages to maybe some lingering cukes hanging around, and start homebrewing for the winter. So a lot of people are getting into fermentation more and more, and a lot of that has to do with the person I'm having on the show today as for this interview. He is one of my top three favorite culinary experts of all time, without any exaggeration. And he is the author of the updated version of Wild Fermentation, The Flavor, Nutrition, and Craft of Live Culture Foods. It's Sandra Alex Katz, of course. How are you?
I am great. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Absolutely. And thanks for joining us again. I remember you came on for The Art of Fermentation. That's a great book about 5 years ago. So welcome back.
No, I remember my first visit to Roberta's very vividly, being being in the fish tank there in the restaurant.
Yes. That's where I am right now. Too bad you couldn't join us again, but it's great that you're back on the station. I was actually just using The Art of Fermentation to quickly double check my ratio for cucumbers. It's something that it works every time.
Well, I make reference to my own recipes all the time, so there you have it.
Yeah, but your recipes are not just measurements. Your recipes add a lot of thought and personal anecdote and opinion too, and I think that that's really important because fermenting is not an exact. I mean, so many factors affect how much you need to ferment and how much this and that and so forth. So,
yeah, I mean, when I wrote the Art of Fermentation, that's a book that's really without recipes. I mean, it's got all the it's got all the proportions or ranges of proportions, but I had really made a decision that I wanted to get out of recipe writing, just because I really don't care whether people use one tablespoon or two tablespoons of sugar. I mean, I feel like that's entirely in the realm of personal choice and preference. So, rather than encouraging people to, sort of follow recipes, what I wanted to do was just give people a sense of, parameters, ranges of proportions of sugar or salt, ideas for seasoning, so that it's like, here's the information, take it and run with it. But, what I learned somewhat from the feedback that I got from The Art of Fermentation is that people like recipes. People felt a little bit lost without recipes. So, that was part of, my decision to revise Wild Fermentation was, if people need recipes and they're following these recipes from when I was starting out what I'm doing and, that I'm always correcting in my conversations to people, I'd better put out better recipes. So, that's really what this revised edition of Wild Fermentation is about, is, another decade of experience as a fermentation educator with a lot clearer, understanding not only of the process, but of, what frequently trips people up in the process.
Okay.
What people are insecure of or afraid of, or just realizing what I had underemphasized or overemphasized. So, you know, the book, you know, in many ways is substantially similar to the original book, but, you know, some recipes are gone, there's new recipes, and I would say all the recipes that are still there, you know, are updated in some way.
Gotcha. So it's been like a whole 15 years since Wild Fermentation first came out. 2003.
Can you believe it? Well, yeah. Wild Fermentation actually was published in 2003, but my original zine version that led me to writing the book, I wrote and published in 2001, so that's 15 years ago. And it's really right on the heels of that I made the connection with Chelsea Green and mm-hmm. decided to write a book and started working on it. So 15 years ago, right now, I was really just beginning work on Wild Fermentation.
Got it. And with Wild Fermentation, kind of like a slow ferment, it that was a dumb metaphor, but it sort of...
No, fermentation offers metaphors for almost
yes,
everything.
Yes, I know. It ripened and sort of crystallized a movement, and it was a re-embracing of fermentation. And that's only grown immensely since then. It's bubbled over, you could say, to continue on this track. And such that, you know, the hottest chefs, you know, I had a Bar Tartine chefs here about a year ago, and they, you know, everybody's tinkering around with fermentation. It is,
right.
You know,
well,
as
they've been tinkering
know.
Around for, with fermentation for a long time.
Yes.
They did not get on the bandwagon. They were, you know, a Bar Tartine was definitely like leaders of the bandwagon.
Right.
No, I mean, I love the stuff that they're doing. They have a new restaurant opening, but I have been admiring their work for a long time.
Right. I mean, there's a show here on this station called Foment About It. I mean, it's a rich topic.
I've been a guest on that show. For
wonderful.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's definitely reached a zeitgeist, or it has been for the last 15 years.
I mean, you
years,
know,
thanks.
My thoughts about that, because I mean, I get to talk to people about this a lot. A lot of people mm-hmm. are like, you know, a lot of times, you know, media interviewers, you know, their first question will be like, so, you know, so fermentation is suddenly a big fad. Well, mm-hmm. and then my perspective on that is, okay, so beer and wine are suddenly popular and bread and cheese are suddenly popular.
And I also had the fermented man on the show.
And kimchi and pickles are suddenly popular. I mean, you know, from my perspective, all of the products of fermentation, or most of the major products of fermentation, have enjoyed enduring popularity. You know, coffee, chocolate, bread, cheese, cured meats, beer, wine. So, I mean, you know, fermentation itself and the products of fermentation have always been integral to, you know, our daily lives. And, you know, there's nothing new or faddish about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that what's new and what's exciting is, you know, so many more people are aware of fermentation, thinking about fermentation. So, I mean, people always enjoy the products of fermentation because they're so integral to all of our culinary traditions. But, you know, sort of throughout, you know, the century where people, you know, got less and less interested in their food and what they were eating mm-hmm. and how it was produced, mm-hmm. you know, although people kept eating the products of fermentation, they were being made in, you know, faraway places and people weren't even necessarily aware that they were fermented. And even if they were, they had no idea of the process. But,
right.
You know, I think it's thrilling that people are becoming more interested in the food that they're eating and where that food comes from and how it's produced. And I think that, you know, it's a really important set of questions to ask about our food and the idea that people, you know, want to be more connected to their food, want to understand where it comes from and how it's produced, and maybe even have a hand in producing it. And those are all exciting things. And, you know, I don't think that's a fad at all. I think it's sort of like a countervailing trend
mm-hmm.
to, you know, the 100 years of, you know, people wanting to have less and less to do with the food that they're eating and being content to be more and more distanced from it and not involved in it. And I sort of get that, you know, for my grandmother's generation, I mean, that was liberation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that enough time has passed that, you know, many people have developed a critique and like, oh, the methods that allow, you know, one person to grow enough food to feed 100 people are environmentally destructive. And the food that the system of food mass production produces is nutritionally diminished and at the root of all of these sort of disease processes that are that have emerged as our new epidemics.
Right.
And so for all these reasons, people are just kind of craving more connection to their food and asking all these questions about how their food was produced and where it comes from. And I think that that's really a good and healthy thing.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, it's interesting, Sandra. Like, I think that fermentation is a sort of a natural byproduct of getting more involved in your food system and where food comes from and cooking more and maybe growing your own food because you're going to have to preserve it. And it's going to come up, hopefully. So
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you know, whether we're talking about food preservation or whether we're talking about a sourdough or whether we're talking about making wine and beer, you know, the reality is that the processes that are involved in transforming the raw products of agriculture into all of the things that people love to eat and drink, you know, involve a lot of different transformative processes, and, you know, prime among them is fermentation.
Right. So you know what words are kind of buzzy, though? Probiotic, gut bacteria. These are things that, nutritionists are starting to hail more and more, and scientists are starting to sort of try to understand a bit more what exactly is going on in our guts and how much bacteria plays into our overall health. And that's why, fermentation has been sort of a star, I guess, in terms of health fads these days as well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a lot of interest in probiotics right now. I mean, I would say that the context for the interest in probiotics is, the idea that, we were all raised in the midst of the war on bacteria and this sort of, ideology that bacteria categorically are, dangerous and associated with disease and danger, and, they need to be avoided, and when encountered, they need to be killed by any means necessary.
So you're talking about the antibacterial hand soaps and the little instant antibacterial stuff that you rub onto your hands and so forth. That's part of the fear?
This kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Antibiotic drugs, antibacterial cleansing products, chlorine in our water.
Bacteria.
The manifestations of the, chemical warfare of the war on bacteria, is all of these chemicals that we have daily contact with that diminish bacterial biodiversity in our bodies. And, science is really learning just how important biodiversity in our intestines in particular is. And, it determines a lot more than our ability to digest our food and assimilate nutrients. Our immune system is mostly the work of bacteria in our intestines. We're learning all this exciting information about, ways in which our gut bacteria regulate serotonin and other chemicals that determine our brain function, how we think and how we feel. They regulate our liver function in ways that we're beginning to learn about, our circulatory function. I mean, almost every aspect of our, functionality of our bodies is related to these gut bacteria that, until 20 years ago, people just thought of as
mystery,
as our enemy to be killed. So, sure, I mean, learning how important these bacteria are is giving rise to a broad interest in strategies to restore biodiversity. And you can buy all kinds of expensive capsules at a natural food store.
Mm-hmm.
And each one is boasting, we have 5 billion cells in each capsule. But even if it's 5 billion cells, generally it's 5 billion copies of, one cell or two or three, whereas traditional fermented foods are literally embodiments of biodiversity.
Yes.
Because in the natural world, you never find singular microorganisms. They exist in communities. So,
right.
On the cabbage is a broad community of organisms. In the resulting sauerkraut, there's a broad community of organisms. But all of the traditional fermented foods and beverages, encompass these broad communities. So if we're really talking about probiotics as biodiversity, then, traditional foods are much more powerful probiotics than the capsules that we can buy, even if, you know, much more clinical research has been done with the capsules because they tend to be proprietary strains. And, you know, sort of nobody's really investing in clinical trials for sauerkraut or for kefir or other traditional foods because nobody owns them and really nobody can own them.
I think it's really interesting because it sounds like formal medicine is really in a very primitive place when it comes to understanding a lot of the bacteria in foods, and that's interesting because that sort of. But obviously, you know, people have known
in terms of understanding the bacteria in our body. I mean,
in our body,
it's so new. Like, you know, biology has only had the tools in the last 15 years or so to begin to study communities of organisms. You know, really up until the new millennium, you know, biology could only culture singular organisms and study the organisms that it was possible to culture, which is actually a rather small subset of microorganisms. So, you know, yes, we are, you know, our knowledge is crude. I mean, our knowledge of the role of bacteria in our bodies is crude. Our knowledge about, you know, the dynamics of the interaction between the bacteria on the food that we eat and the bacteria that are in residence already in our intestines is very crude. We know that there's an elaborate interaction. We can measure some of the effects that it has on our immunity, on our digestion, on nutrient bioavailability, but, you know, we don't really exactly understand what the mechanisms are.
That's fascinating. And yet, you know, we've been around for since, and also fermented foods have been, is as old as you write, as humanity. So that's... It's
well,
kind of wonderful.
Older, yeah. I would argue. I mean, you know, I mean, alcohol
animals, right.
ferments, you know, spontaneously on sweet things with us or without us. It doesn't need us. And, you know, there's lots of interesting examples of, you know, insects, birds, small mammals, large mammals being attracted to the smell of alcohol and gorging themselves on fermenting fruit.
Right.
So, and, you know, we somehow evolved with the enzymes to digest alcohol. So presumably, you know, our primate ancestors were, you know, somewhat familiar with this phenomenon.
Presumably, yes. The dinosaurs, sure. I mean, rotting flesh around, I don't know.
Or maybe it's not rotting flesh, but fermenting berries. But
okay. Sander, let's cut to a quick little commercial interlude and we'll be right back chatting more.
Okay.
Okay.
New York chefs and restaurants are proud of the food they put on the table. And serving produce that comes from local, environmentally responsible farms is a way to leave an even better taste in everyone's mouth. So when shopping for your ingredients, look for the New York State Grown and Certified seal. It lets you know which food is grown right here in New York State, certifying the food that comes from local farms that meet a higher standard. You'll not only be serving local food, you'll be supporting local farmers. Learn more about the New York State Grown and Certified program at certified.ny.gov.
All right, we're back chatting with Sander Ellix-Katz, whose updated version of Wild Fermentation, the book that sort of caused a revolution in 2003, is coming out right now. So, Sander, you write that this book, the first version of Wild Fermentation, changed your life. And I have to say, when I first heard about from Chelsea Green that you were publishing an updated version, I almost was a little sad. Like, I kind of was like, oh no, because it's sort of like a Bible. Did it feel weird to touch and tamper with the original?
Well, I mean, not really. I mean, I share a sense of nostalgia about it.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because that book was such a huge landmark in my own life,
right.
And you know, it's been the book has done really well, and you know, there's you know, lots of copies of it floating around, and because of the like kind of loud, garish cover, you know, I could see it on somebody's somebody's bookshelves from, you know, 100 feet away, and it would just jump out at me. So, I mean, I had a little bit of sadness, but... You know, but really, I feel like in person, I've been correcting that book for years.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I'd say, well, look in Wild Fermentation and, you know, roughly follow that recipe, but, you know, maybe don't use as much salt and maybe do this and maybe don't do that. So, you know, I for years, I've been kind of correcting myself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, honestly, when Art of Fermentation came out, I kind of figured that that would eclipse Wild Fermentation and that Wild Fermentation would, you know, just kind of you know, drift into obscurity. But, you know, what I learned is that, you know, for many people, a 500-page book is just too much information. I got a lot of that, too much information.
Okay.
So I get that many people, like, you know, just don't have the time or level of interest that they want to read quite so much about it, and they just want you to cut to the chase and give them the most relevant information.
Yeah.
And so I just decided, well, I'm a more experienced fermentation educator now. I'm going to just sort of take this book apart and do a better job of it. And, you know, once I was doing it, there were so many small things I wanted to change. I mean, I'm not telling people to throw away their old copies. Their old copies are really still great. But, you know, any kind of a book is like a little bit like a time capsule. And, you know, it's just what was, you know, sort of in the mind of the person who was writing it at the moment when they wrote it. And then life goes on and, you know, and your learning curve continues. And, you know, at some point you look back and you think, like, wow, that was really imperfect. And, you know, and I can see all these ways that I could make it better. And I have no doubt that 5 years from now I'll look back at the revised copy and I'll be like, oh, this has imperfections too.
Yeah.
But I haven't come up with any of those yet. But I mean, Wild Fermentation changed my life in a huge way, and in lots of huge ways. But I mean, the biggest thing is that, you know, the experience that led me to write Wild Fermentation was, you know, I was living in this remote rural homestead community, and you know, I was just pouring myself for years into growing food and making food for people.
Right.
And I love that. And, you know, I'll tell you, when I have like a few weeks at home and I can just really kind of nest in the kitchen and the garden, I mean, I just feel like I'm at my happiest then. You know, but in, you know, my book tour for Wild Fermentation, I discovered, you know, what a hunger there is for this information. And, you know, really what began as a book tour to promote Wild Fermentation in 2003 has kind of become a way of life for me. And I've become an itinerant fermentation educator.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I really have not systematically counted my workshops. I don't think I've quite gotten to 1,000 yet, but I think I'm probably hovering very close to 1,000 workshops. And, you know, that's definitely changed my way of life.
And I love how
I travel mm-hmm. all the time. It's very rare the month where I'm like at home for a whole month without going anywhere and teaching. And so that's the biggest way that my life has changed. And I don't mean to complain about it. I mean, it's, you know, it's very you know, exciting to me that I get invited around the world and people, you know, sort of pay my way to travel to faraway places that, you know, that I'd love to see anyway, and bring me there. And I get to meet all of these sort of, you know, passionate people who are, you know, excited to hear what I'm talking about. And I get to, you know, taste all kinds of different fermented foods and beverages, you know, in their indigenous context, you know, made by people who've been making them all their lives. So, you know, this definitely has, you know, incredibly enhanced my you know, sort of knowledge of fermentation.
I love that you shared that in this book too, because I thought that was a great addition. Sharing the stories and the photos of folks like, there's a photo of you and Dr. Vandana Shiva. And then you went to the Himalayan village, where you're making, grain fermentations. And then you visited a miso maker in Alaska. And, you know, this book really has a great, sort of travelogue feel to it from all your journeys and all your experiences meeting these folks, as well as new recipes.
That was really fun. Like, you know, going through all the photographs and picking out interesting things to include. But I'm glad you enjoyed that. Thank you.
Yeah, and then somebody made a miso sculpture of yourself.
Wasn't that hilarious?
Tempeh and miso.
Tempeh and miso Sandor. That was a fermentation group in Brisbane, Queensland, in Australia. No, that's the best gift I've ever received. Was at the end of this 2-day workshop, they presented me with this bust of myself made out of tempeh with the hair as miso.
That's hilarious. Yeah, it's just delightful. And I got to say, I had nothing to be scared about initially when hearing about this book, because it's everything and then some more recipes. So really, thank you for doing this. It's a really fun read.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right. Well, I guess that's about all the time we've got for today's interview, but we'll definitely be spreading the fermentation fervor. And everyone check out the latest updated version of Wild Fermentation, out now from Chelsea Green. Sandor, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, well, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely. And thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Ooh, I like the way you do.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.